This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. 2019 marked the warmest year on record in North Carolina, a trend that is expected to continue as scientists project that the annual average temperature in this state will increase between 2 and 5 degrees by the year 2050. And though that warmer Earth temperature may still be some years off, the effects of climate change are already being felt by those who work outdoors all day. For a new 7-part series called Danger Beyond the Beach, Report for America fellow Adam Wagner and News and Observer reporter Aaron Sanchez-Guerra talked to some North Carolina farm workers about experiencing heat illness due to rising temperatures. And they join me now to talk about their work. Adam, welcome.
Hi, Frank. Thanks for having us.
Good. And Aaron, thanks for joining us.
Morning, Frank.
Adam, let me ask you, about 150,000 farm workers harvest North Carolina's crops. So how many of them suffer from heat illness?
Well, that's really unclear because heat illness is not a reported statistic. So if someone's feeling woozy in a field or something like that, there's not someone there to write it down. But some researchers from Wake Forest University did take a look at this and surveyed about 100 farm workers over the course of a summer and found that of those, about 36% had reported suffering heat illness, while 67% had said they worked in what they called extremely hot temperatures.
And so what are some of the symptoms related to heat illness? As you say, it's not reported as an illness, but there are symptoms. At what temperatures does working outdoors become unsafe? Do we know that, Adam?
The risk obviously rises as temperature rises, but the sort of lower bound of this is heat index, which is a mixture of humidity and temperature of about 83.4 degrees, which is lower than I think a lot of people would expect.
Yeah. Well, Aaron, you and Adam both spend time talking directly to workers. What kind of stories are you hearing? How are they feeling the heat?
Yeah, so the stories that the workers are telling us and are very much the larger story of migrant farm worker labor in North Carolina at large, which is that there almost is no new story. And that's because the conditions that they work under, the housing that they have, the rules that they work under, haven't really changed. And they set them up for trouble, in many ways on the job, including, having to work a lot, on the fields and in spite of the heat, having just 1 to 2 short breaks per work shift, just to come back to crowded housing that is also hot and is something that, that they really can't escape.
Well, let's break some of that down. What are they reporting in terms of how they feel, how they're experiencing the heat during the day? What kind of symptoms are they experiencing?
Yes, well, the workers who are more sensitive at times than other workers who may be more seasoned and have been coming to the United States to work for years more than they have, they experience fatigue. Part of working under the heat is, being more easily dehydrated. They're dizzy, and they can get some cramps. And the issue is that while the heat is a constant problem, another constant problem for many of these workers is green tobacco sickness. The majority of them in North Carolina, they work in our leading industry of tobacco, and they have to work in the middle of these giant tobacco leaves for hours and hours. Many of these leaves may have dew on them from the morning. They may be wet from a recent rain, and they're dangerous to human beings given that they have extremely high amounts of nicotine when they're wet, and they can permeate the skin. And so while many of these workers are protected, they are damaged by the tobacco when they have prolonged exposure, when it even permeates and it goes through their clothes. And that has fever-like symptoms where they can't eat, They can't sleep. The symptoms can range, but that can be a constant problem, especially for newer and younger workers who don't know how to protect themselves as good as other ones.
And you, as you indicated, there's no real relief. Talk about the living conditions, the housing conditions that workers find themselves in.
Mm-hmm. So Adam and I, we visited some worker housing and that were in barracks, which is some of the most common kinds of housing besides old houses and trailers that H-2A farm workers live in. And while some might have air conditioning, they set it to the lowest setting, and it's still a little bit warm in there. But it does provide some respite from the heat, but they're still sharing that room with another person, so it's a little hotter than they would like. And for other workers, they're restricted to just fans. They do not have air conditioning because it's not required by their growers. And the issue with that, and they told Adam and I that, you know, they come back from working in the heat just to go lay down in the heat, and those fans are blowing hot air, and It makes it hard to sleep at night. And, you know, less sleep means less strength in the workday, and it's something that they said they're getting used to, that they get used to, but they told us, you know, some days you don't even want to wake up and go to work.
And you never really properly cool down. And Adam, I know you spoke to a researcher who tracked the number of days per year that are considered unworkable due to heat in North Carolina. What did you find?
Sure. So this goes back to that 83.4 degree number. And this is a researcher who at the time was at the University of Washington, who ended up going county by county and looking at the number of days that are unworkable or considered high risk now, in other words, hitting the 83.4 degree number, and the number of days that would be risky under certain warming scenarios. So we use Duplin County as an example in the story, which is obviously a big agricultural area. And they had 41 days that are unsafe now, 91 in a 2 degree Celsius warming scenario, and 121 in a 4 degree Celsius scenario. So what that really means is that as the world continues to warm, we're going to hit a point where much or all of the growing season is high risk for these workers, and there are, North Carolina, absolutely no protections in place.
What about other states, Adam? Some states, including California and Washington, have implemented heat standards for outdoor workers. North Carolina apparently no such standards. What are some of those standards, and what might change look like? How would they change in this state, just compared to, say, California and Washington?
Sure. So the biggest thing with the heat standards is that, one, it requires training for the workers. So the growers and the farmers have to tell them, here's what heat illness looks like, here's what you do if you experience heat illness. It also requires breaks at certain temperatures and mandates hydration. So make sure that a certain number of water is available to the workers. You know they're going to be sweating a lot more in high temperatures. Keep them hydrated. Also, make sure they sit in shade. So in California, they actually have a lot of the growers have these trailer-type things that have little canopies on top of them. And when the temperatures hit a certain, I think it's 90 degrees, every 2 hours they've got to let the workers rest for 5 minutes. Just sort of cool down, give everyone kind of a conscious chance to avoid heat stress.
Adam Wagner, a Report for America reporter with the News and Observer. Adam, thank you so much.
Thank you, Frank.
Aaron Sanchez-Guerra is a reporter for the News and Observer. Aaron, thank you.
Thanks for having us, Frank.
Well, heat is not the only health risk created by climate change. Vibrio is a bacteria that lives in the coastal waters of the Carolinas. It can cause extreme illness, including severe skin infection. In some cases, Vibrio can be fatal. As the Earth's temperature and sea level increase, the number of Vibrio infections is on a gradual rise. Sammy Fretwell is an environmental reporter for the state in Columbia, South Carolina, and he took a look at the growing presence of Vibrio in Carolina waters for the Danger Beyond the Beach series. Sammy, welcome.
Good to be here.
Let's talk more about the Vibrio infection. What are some of the symptoms?
Well, you can. There are multiple symptoms. In the worst case, it can enter a wound, or you can eat an oyster that's infected, and it can send toxins into your bloodstream and basically shut down your organs and kill you in a matter of days. Other types of threats from Vibrio are wound infections that aren't fatal, but they're pretty nasty. I mean, they can take a small wound and just expand it substantially, and you can end up losing a limb fairly easily from such infections. So it's something to pay attention to.
Yeah, I think if people knew anything about Vibrio, they probably associated it with uncooked or not properly cooked seafood. In other words, things that you ingest. But as you point out, it can also infect an open wound and then create necrotic tissue. In other words, kill the tissue around there and be pretty nasty. So in both ways, it can affect you. The bacteria appear in high concentrations when the water is warmer. So that's usually between May and October. But tell us how climate change has affected its growth.
Well, you're seeing on the edges of the season, so to speak, April and October, you're seeing water temperatures warmer now than you did in the past. And that continues to keep conditions right for Vibrio. We found that, for instance, in Charleston Harbor, the water temperatures were up, I think, about 3 degrees since 1950 at the end of the season, so to speak. So it's warmer longer. The same thing was found in other places. So you have this longer season, but you also have more intense hurricanes that are occurring. And it's interesting with Vibrio, you have the encroachment of salt water going up into rivers, which creates conditions that are right for it. Vibrio likes a lot of different types of Vibrio, like more brackish water. So they don't like it too salty. They don't like it too fresh. But when that water moves, sea level rises, it moves saltier water farther into rivers that were normally fresh. On the flip side, you get these heavy rains from storms, and it can send all this water cascading down these rivers, and can push fresher water closer to the beaches and create conditions that are suitable for Vibrio as well. So, the change in climate is having an effect on this this microbe.
And I know there are several hot spots in the Carolinas. Where are they, and what do they have in common?
Well, there's some places along the North Carolina coast near the Outer Banks. They've found a good bit of Rachel Noble at UNC found fairly large increases in Vibrio after one of the recent hurricanes. You also, in that same, in the Neuse River area near the Pamlico Sound, there was a 10-year study done that showed that overall Vibrio concentrations were rising, and they continued to rise even after the study ended, and they went back and checked again. So that's one place. You see it on the South Carolina coast as well. It looks like the Horry County up into Brunswick County is kind of a contiguous area where there are a number of Vibrio cases that have popped up. So those are some of the places, and it's clearly seen more on the coast than inland. You can get Vibrio cases inland, but those often are related to eating raw shellfish in a restaurant, or it could be someone leaving the coast and going back inland, but still the coastal areas are the hot spot, so to speak.
Is this the sort of thing you can test for, on the spot and then perhaps issue warnings if necessary? And has that happened yet?
Well, warnings are not generally issued for Vibrio. It's pretty rare from what we found, at least in the Carolinas. The North Carolina Beach Program does not post signs or test for Vibrio. And this is the same in South Carolina. I think there's been one Vibrio warning by the State Department of Health and Environmental Control here. And I think the argument they make is that it's not common enough to issue specific warnings. The interesting thing about it is that the numbers show that it's rising. It's certainly not any kind of epidemic right now, but the changing climate is causing this microbe to be found more often and in places where it wasn't normally seen before.
Any idea what the rate of change is over the past, decade or so?
Wow. I'm trying to remember that statistic there. I'd have to refer to my notes on that.
Well, we will refer our listeners to your notes and to your reporting. I'm talking to Sammy Fretwell, who's a reporter for the state, and I'm having that conversation right here on the State of Things. Your reporting also found that hospitals don't always know what to do with Vibrio-infected patients when they come in for treatment. Is that true?
Yeah, what we found was that the infectious disease doctors have a feel for what to do, but sometimes the ER doctors are not as familiar with how to identify Vibrio right away. At least that's what some of the experts that we had talked to about have told us. That's something that's, important because, what they tell us is you need to diagnose this quickly because if you have a very bad infection, you can, end up, dying in several days if it's not diagnosed, in the worst cases. So, it's important to size this up quickly. And, I think that's an area that needs to improve in some areas. Again, infectious disease doctors know this, but it's some of the ones that are not specialists in infectious diseases that may need some more training.
And if the rate increases in the waters, they're more likely to see this. That rate in terms of ER and ED visits are going to increase too. You said that
Sure. They're
not issuing warnings kind of along the coast, but what about state agencies? Are they taking any approach to alerting people to the dangers? Are the ideas about how to alert people beginning to change at the regulatory level?
Well, what we found was we didn't find a lot of that at the health and environmental agencies in the states of North and South Carolina, but there is a good bit of research going on at the university level. UNC, Rachel Noble is doing a good bit of research up there, and we've got researchers here in Columbia at the University of South Carolina who have an initiative to learn more about Vibrio. And the ultimate goal is to develop some kind of a warning system so that people will know when there are Vibrio outbreaks and to avoid the water when those things occur. That is still in the process. It's been done, I think, in the Chesapeake Bay, but they're still refining it, trying to figure out how to tailor it specifically to the more toxic forms of Vibrio.
What about, we've been talking about the human toll so far, but this is something that is a growing presence in the water, and we know that ecology, from our understanding of ecology, that there are then broad ripple effects that move through the entire ecosystem. What do we know about the effects of other organisms on other organisms?
Well, I didn't run across a lot of research on the effects on other organisms. I think that most of the research has been more about human health impacts, I think, because I think that's the thing that's most immediate in people's minds. But that's an area that I need to learn more about.
And what about when we talk about ingesting it? So, obviously open wound, that's when we have the skin infection. Ingesting maybe raw seafood, would that mean if there's more of it, the seafood itself, oysters, et cetera, are more likely to come in contact with this? I guess it's logical. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean that's the concern is it becomes more prevalent or more of it is in the water, then there's more types of more shellfish that could be affected by it. So it's the one thing about that though is that this is about raw seafood. And right. If you cook the oysters, fry the oysters, whatever, the experts are telling us that takes away a lot of the threat.
All right, Sammy Fretwell, reporter for the state in Columbia, South Carolina. Sammy, thank you so much.
Great, thanks so much.
You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.